Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Hello there, you're very welcome along to another edition of Golf Weekly. It's great to have you with us. If you're listening on the podcast, we have a fantastic lineup for you. If you're listening on the radio on Sunday, very nice to have you along. And if you're watching on YouTube, then you can see the lineup. We have Fionn Davenport, as usual, in his home. Hello, Fionn.
Afternoon, gents.
We have Peter Laurie with us. Peter, how are you?
Hiya, Joe. How are you?
I'm very well. And then I'm delighted to say he's made some time for us. Usually he would be otherwise engaged, I'm sure, with tournaments or TV work or any number of things. He is a 15-time professional winner in the game of golf, a PGA Tour winner in 1997, a five-time European winner. He has had top 10 finishes in all four majors. And in the main now, we know him and see him on our television screens all year round. Very happy to say the dulcet tones of Frank Nabilo are with us. Frank, how you doing?
Very good, thanks, Joe. But please, don't go Gaelic on me because I will have no chance of understanding.
me neither, to tell you the truth. So,
no, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank where you. Are you living? Where are you based? Obviously, stateside now.
Yeah, I actually played a World Cup at a place called Lake Nona. You'll know Henrik Stenson lives there, Graham McDowell in Poulter and the likes. But I played here in 1993, my girlfriend then. And I always thought if and when I went to play in America full time, this is where I'd want to live. So we moved here in 1997. Haven't moved since. So 23 years, 24 years now.
It seems to be a very, 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 very nice part of the world.
It is. A lot of players want to live in a golf community. Obviously, the weather in Florida means that you can practice, 12 months a year. So that's very conducive. Doesn't matter where you play in the world. Players like Ben Ahn, a lot more younger players. And it could be on the LPGA, like Lydia Ko. They also live here now. Some tennis players. So you have the weather for a start. You get sport with the conditions. And you also don't feel like you're in the middle of a city. This is, if Orlando per se was a pizza, this little slice out here by the airport was always sort of, it lacked infrastructure, except for Lake Nona itself. It's starting to grow now. So it's actually very, very peaceful, even in these sort of troubling times right now.
I was there. I literally got back on I flew in on the 4th of March. I flew back after spending a month. And I made the pilgrimage out to Nona Blue because obviously G-Max place. And
did you have the ribs?
No, actually, no. I had a really nice burger, though. It was a good burger. And what struck me is that Lake Nona itself, like a lot of these suburban communities around Orlando, as you described them, they're kind of self-contained. And at a certain point, you're kind of going, okay, it's fairly nondescript in a lot of ways. And then you see the gates to Lake Nona, the golf community, and then you realize, oh my God, once you go through these gates, it's like, it's a whole other thing. I mean, it looks stunningly gorgeous inside. I didn't get in, but I could see it from outside.
You should have come in, Fionn. We are spoiled here. There's no doubt. And given the coronavirus right now, the community itself almost feels like it's a satellite city. So I'm not going to say we feel safe, but my wife's just popped out to get some groceries. But you do sort of feel a little detached, which right now is actually not a bad thing. But, you're spoiled. You should have come out and you actually should have played a round of golf, really.
I know.
We would have got
to regret it now. But in fact, back again. I'll be back again because the other hat I wear besides this one is as a travel writer. So when I go back again, I will 100% be reaching out. So definitely. I look forward to it very much.
Are you going stir crazy or how is it?
No, not really. For me, I changed. I was doing Golf Channel and CBS up until this year. And to be honest, I'm going to turn 60. I can't hide that this year. And I was almost feeling like I was getting burned out. A little bit like when I had to stop playing golf professionally. So for me, I'm trying to look at it from a positive point of view and actually have a break, read a few books. I'm in my office right now. There's books everywhere. So I'm about 50, 60 books behind, things like that. And I've just been on the road since I was 19 years of age. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, I'm trying to look at it just as an opportunity. My daughter lives in London. I try and speak to her when I can. She works for CNN. My parents still live in New Zealand. They're scattered around there. My wife's parents live in the Far East. So we spend a lot of the day clock, so to speak, ringing my wife's parents in the morning, try and chat to my daughter in the middle of the day, and then my parents sort of late in the day. So the days actually go so far, fairly smoothly. We're not quite stir crazy yet. Close, though. And the alcohol consumption, the wine cellar's going down.
I was reading a few interviews you had done, and certainly in your formative years, golf, and you're talking to golf nuts here, both us three and beyond. Golf for you was almost a respite from the world.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, Peter can testify to that. You know, as a young kid growing up in New Zealand, I remember at school studying French one year, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm never going to go to Europe. So I actually quit the class and took up accounting for some stupid reason. And then within a couple of years, there I was in Paris. So for me, it's been my education culturally, everything, you know, pro-ams, for example, playing with CEOs, it kept me healthy. It was an outdoor sport until I got diagnosed with inflammatory polyarthritis. And then even now it gave me a second job. So yeah. At times I was angry with the game when I couldn't play anymore. But then when I look back retrospectively, it's given me everything. I wouldn't be talking to you. I wouldn't have half the core group of people that I trust right now. So sometimes you just have to change a little perspective. Yeah. So I've been very, very fortunate through golf.
Yeah. If we touch on the end then briefly, because I do want to chat to you a bit about your career as well and hear about your playing career. The end was kind of cruel because it seemed like you were in a really good spot. You know, mid-90s, you were playing really good golf. I think there was a period there, 95 to 97, where you had top 10 finishes in all majors. And often when a player's doing that, he's really trending towards doing something. So when were you diagnosed with the arthritis, and was it pretty much just an immediate halt to your golfing career?
Yeah, it was, Joe. 1996 was one of my best years in the majors. As a matter of fact, only two players had lower scoring averages that year, and that was Faldo and Norman. So I'd also won the Tournament Players Championship in Europe, and it was perfect really to take up my playing opportunity in America. And so I thought I could play both. My daughter was living in London, so hence the move to Orlando here, where you could jump on a plane and go backwards and forwards. And so my rookie year, 1997, I remember actually in Florida going to a tournament called the Honda, and my wrist blew up. I couldn't even put a watch on. And so in March of 1997, my rookie year over here, I was diagnosed with inflammatory polyarthritis after 3 days at the Mayo Clinic. Now, I kept playing that year. I managed to win. And actually, I broke the money record for a rookie. They wouldn't give it to me because I'd played too many events in the past on the PGA Tour. But it was bittersweet. It really, 1997, I think I won in Mexico as well as Hong Kong. But that was the last time I ever won a tournament. And it was a steady decline. I kept trying to play all the way up into 2002. And it just got worse. I was on three drugs, which is a Wanda drug, but it's a corticosteroid. Imuran, which is an immunosuppressant, and Plaquenil, which is almost like a mild form of chemotherapy. And then when I did some research on those, and you add up what it does to your life, like when you're my age, the choice really was, do you still want to keep playing and take that type of medication, or choose another life and actually wean yourself off that? And so I chose the latter. And touch wood now, you know, I can do everything I want to do except, sadly, play golf, you know, at a high level.
Really? So if you went out with a couple of buddies and played 2 or 3 days in a row because you just couldn't resist, what price are you paying with your body?
When I would hit balls, you know, obviously if I could warm up and it was half decent, I would be fine on day one. Probably day two would be pretty good, and day three I could probably barely walk. It would just like literally grind to a halt, almost like an old car. And it was bizarre. And that was the issue I had on the last couple of years when I was trying to play. In the mornings, when the greens are the best and the wind's probably at its most calm, that's when I would struggle. I'd be stiff. I'd be fine 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think most rheumatoid arthritis sufferers feel the same thing. They're always better in the afternoon. So, and it was, I was angry like everybody else. 2003, I didn't do anything. I was contemplating going back to New Zealand full time. I still keep a place there. And then lo and behold, the Golf Channel, they were looking for people. I didn't want to do it, and probably shouldn't have really. But it all changed. And then eventually to be honest, it took about 4 or 5 years. I had the same conversation with David Duval, because when David also stopped with injury, he's going through what I went through in the first 4 or 5 years. Some people just think it's an easy transition, but it's not. You know, I can see a picture of a rugby player in the back there. You know, you see athletes run all over the field, but you forget what they're like when, for example, a rugby player, when he's in his late 30s or 40 years of age, and some of them can barely walk. So things can change quickly.
Frank, I describe it as it was like being in mourning when we stopped playing. And you're kind of grieving for something, but you couldn't get over this grief. And even for me, I finished in 2016, which is what, 4 years ago. And still to this day, I would still love to be out there. But there is a thing that people don't realize that, yeah, the transition is so difficult and there's nobody to talk to. You know, you try and talk to a couple of other guys who have been down that road. But it's all what you have to work within yourself. And I hear exactly what you're saying, like, you know, doing commentary, it's probably worse because you have to go to the golf course every day, but you're not involved. You know, you're only commentating on it. And for me, that was very, very difficult. It took me 2 years to go back to actually, you know, even starting to watch golf again. So I feel your pain.
Yeah, I agree with you, Peter. And I know, you know, you grew up in a golfing era. You know, Dublin, it's one of my favorite golf courses, Portmarnock, just down the road. So when you're exposed to it, you can't run away from it. So I think you're dead right. And everybody goes, hey, Peter, you know, like, do you want to play tomorrow? Or what's going on? When are you playing next? And when you tell them you stop, you look healthy. And they don't differentiate between playing at the highest level and being 5 or 10% down from that, because that's the difference between having a career. And you're right, then it becomes lonely because you don't know who to talk to where you can have the conversation that we're just having now. And it takes you a few years to find those people. I remember even players like Ernie or Vijay, they were angry at me because they're like, why aren't you playing? It's like, I quit because you look normal. It's like, well, you're quitting. And they don't get it. So you lose some friendships, you lose a little bit of perspective, and it's tough. I can now identify with people that have a sick sibling or a sick spouse. It does open your eyes to a lot of different, you know, things that happen in life.
Well, for you in particular, I could understand the bitterness because I'm sure there are pros
growing up in New Zealand.
Yeah, indeed. There are pros out there who, you know, they lose their game, and maybe the sight of a professional golf tournament almost terrifies them because they know on some deep level they don't quite have what they had. Whereas for you, you were in a really good spot by the looks of things, and maybe poised to fulfill the potential I'm sure you felt you had. And when it's taken away by injury, then that's another layer on top of the loss, I suspect.
Yeah, Joe, you're not making me feel any better.
You're living in Florida. You have a great life. It's okay. This is not a tragedy.
No, you nailed it. No, you nailed it, Joe. That's exactly how you felt. The first year, I didn't want to do anything involved with golf. And Peter's right, too. When I first started doing commentary and I went to a golf course, it was tough. The good thing, though, or where I was lucky, is the first couple of years – I commentated on Champions Tour or 50 and above. So even though I knew a lot of those players at that stage, I was still 10 years short of that age group. So I felt like I wasn't seeing the people I was playing with yesterday on a daily basis. I would only see them at the major championships. And that was tough to take. But so I did have a little bit of a sort of a sidestep. But, you know, Peter nailed it too. You know, you just feel you feel like nobody else understands what you're going through. But the flip side is once you turn the corner, you then realize, you know, golf is still an amazing game. And like I said, it's your core group where you pull from. I know more amateur golfers now that, to be honest, I probably didn't talk to that much before, even members here, because you're in and out. It was business. You went to the range. You were dedicated. You were trying to practice. It was like, hey, don't get in my way. You know, I'm sorry. Can we chat tomorrow? Next minute you're on a plane. But then when you stop, and as they say, smell the roses, you realize when you look left and look right, there's actually a lot of good people there. Mm-hmm. And it's better when you just talk about their lives and you start to realize that maybe it's not so bad. But it does take a while to get over the bitter and twistedness of growing up
Frank,
and living
it. What, I mean, you're describing in whatever walk of life where you feel, where you hit a roadblock, a major roadblock, and have to reassess or kind of redirect all of your energies in a whole new direction. Did you find, is it inner resources that you found, or was it outer resources? In what way, other than the coping mechanisms, in what way did you find that you used something that helped you get over this fairly dramatic hurdle?
A great question, Finn. One thing at that particular stage, my daughter was growing up, you know, so she's in her teenage years. So you have a responsibility My wife was tremendous. She it was a combination of letting me be, in other words, when I wanted to stop, and also just kicking me in the pants. And some, like I said, a core group of different people. To be honest, it's not unlike what's happening right now when, you know, you turn on the news and I saw a whole family of four, I think it was in Italy, that all passed away, a whole family, through something that you can't see as a virus. So, you know, you can't see the future and what you're doing in golf. And it seems like kind of minuscule with what's going on right now. But it is, it's, you have to, you just change the perspective. You realize, like, even what we're just talking about right now, where we're this social separation, in the big scheme of things, it's actually not that bad. You just have to change your perspective. I didn't realize at the time how spoiled and how lucky I was. So when I talk to guys on the tour and they're bitching and moaning, just like I did, I go, hey guys, play as long as you can. I remember having that conversation with Nick Price, who was thinking about doing commentary at one stage. And the Champions Tour, for example, had got very lucrative, probably on the same level of money, and that is what he would have earned when he was playing on the regular tour. And I said, number one, it'll keep you healthy. And number two, you're going to be your own boss. You won't realize how lucky you have. You can go home when you want. You can play when you want. So I guess it's you know, everybody wants to be spoiled every day, and then you just get a dose of the real world. And then, like I said, you start looking around, and you realize everyday people are the ones that are going to heal you. And you just identify with life, because you're lucky to be that 0.001%, but then you do have to wake up and say, you know, I was really lucky, and actually I was spoiled. Yeah. And then you get over the hurdle.
Peter often remarks that he got to be CEO of his own company for about 20 years.
That was another thing you brought up there, Frank. It was very difficult. When you stop playing and then you go take a job somewhere, is not being your own boss. Like you just said about Nick Price, you know, you can go home and you can do whatever you like. And then you realize, I meant to ask somebody, can I do this? And that never came into the situation before. And you have the thing done already, and then you go, oh shit, I was meant to ask somebody that.
Well, you know, when you're playing golf, when you choose whatever shot you want to hit, and you hit a bad shot, you're never wrong. You know, it's the caddy or it's someone else. You try and telling your boss that, you know, he's decided to put you on a show or a rundown or whatever, and that's wrong. And you think, like golf, you can just blame somebody else and move on, because really that's the way you do it. You know, every shot you're going to hit, that's the right shot at the right time. And then when it doesn't come off, invariably it's somebody else's fault. So you can go ahead and play the other one. That strategy doesn't often work in business.
So we should change tack here, because we're feeling too sorry for you at this stage. And there were a lot of good days as well. I was just looking at your PGA Tour win and your 5 European Tour wins, and something jumped off the page immediately. You beat Brad Faxon in a playoff on the PGA Tour. And then on the European Tour, 4 of your 5 wins were by a single shot, and the 5th was just by 2 shots. And you were holding off some serious names as well, the likes of Langer, and I think Ian Baker Finch was there, and maybe Monty one time as well. So did Frank Nobilo have a stubborn streak that liked a competitive, tough, grim kind of back nine?
Well, Joe, I could always say I had a 4-shot lead and just blew it towards the end and just sneaked in. So I'm gonna choose what you said. Okay. I won 2 Sarahs in World Opens, and I just realized that, well, one, I beat Jimenez by a single shot. And then Scott Hoke, I think, was only by 1 or 2 as well. You know, I never really noticed that. Probably just as well.
Were you a leaderboard watcher?
You have to be. Early on, I wasn't. And then I was told by better players, you should know where you stand. Matter of fact, actually, I got in trouble with one of the younger guys. I was doing a tournament in Vegas, and the year Smiley Kaufman won, when he actually had a good run in the Masters when he was playing with Jordan Spieth. And he shot 61, and there was a young, talented player called Patton Kizzire who had the lead but had to birdie the 18th hole to tie. And he had a nice drive, and his approach shot came up about 30 feet short, and he left the putt short. I was working with Gary Koch. And he tapped it in calmly, and he had no idea. And he thought he might have either won or whatever. And he was surprised that he didn't win. And someone said, well, you know, didn't you look at the leaderboard to know your situation? He said, I don't look at leaderboards. So both Gary and I, or Gary, I think, was the lead analyst that day. He said, well, he'll learn. Mm-hmm. And he took offense to that. It's like, well, you know, don't tell me how to play. You know, the psychologists had told him 1 shot at a time. But yeah, the best, the Nicholases, the Woods, the Peter Thompsons, the Henry Cottons. When you come down to the back nine, people aren't going to play as well as what they do. You know, like the All Blacks in rugby, for example, they know with the last 10 or 15 minutes, it's more about not making mistakes than the fantastic play. And golf is no different, or any sport, really, when it comes to that. So you have to have an idea. You don't necessarily have to play your best. You just have to be smart, make good decisions. And as Jack Nicklaus would say, you wait one more hole. You just wait one more hole. In other words, you play the right shot on that hole, what you would normally do, 10 feet right, 15 feet left, then go to the next hole, next. And the only time you really pull the trigger is when you have to. So you have to be cognizant of that situation.
I think I'm right in saying quite often, because of the alphabet more than anything, you had a locker sometimes next to Jack Nicklaus when you came on the scene. That's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, no, it was. Alphabetically, when you go on there, and you're right, you know, A, B, C, D. So mine often was next to Nicklaus and Norman, which was pretty intimidating. But I remember the first time I sort of rubbed shoulders with him, and I was in my early 20s. And it might have been in Europe, actually. And I was, like, nervous. Actually, I think it was the 1985 or 86 Open Championship at Turnberry, oddly enough. And he was like, what's up? And he knew my name, which I was really surprised. I mean, that sort of threw me for a loop. And he goes, you know, what's wrong? And I'm like, I'm really nervous, thinking that he was just going to shake me off. And I learned that day because he said, isn't that great? That's what you play for. And I'm like, wow. At that stage, the greatest player of all time has admitted to being nervous. So for me, that was an eye-opener. I just always thought that the best were cool customers. They never made a mistake. They're always in control, and they weren't really nervous. And I thought I was the only one jumping out of their skin. So for me, number one, I think that he was honest enough to say that. But also, it was a life lesson.
Well, a lot of guys, especially as they progress through their career, even Harrington of late, would say, you know, that the toughest days he finds are the Thursdays. He wants the adrenaline to play his best stuff, Peter.
Absolutely. And you know, you need to get you going in a golf tournament. And Frank, you brought up a thing about Jack Nicklaus there. I've told the lads this story before, but Jack Nicklaus came over to Luttrellstown to play in a... he was invited over by JP McManus. He was there with his wife. They were at dinner. I had played the Pro-Am in the morning time. I'd come in, and I had only started, you know, probably it was early 97, 98. And, you know, there's the number one player who has ever walked the world sitting in a table next to me. And I didn't have I was so nervous, I couldn't go over and talk to him. And you were very, very lucky to be able to talk to, you know, Jack Nicklaus with a locker right beside him, because, you know, you could learn so much from somebody of that stature.
Yeah, they're intimidating. There's no question. I remember as a 20-year-old, there's a tournament in Melbourne called the Victorian Open at a golf course called Metropolitan. I remember as a young kid, in those days, Peter, I don't know, you were younger than me. Did you ever have the shag bag days where you'd send your caddy out and he would pick the balls up? Yeah.
No, I was one of the spoiled ones.
Oh, right. Well, okay, in my day, you know, so you'd have your shag bag and your caddy would go out there. I mean, caddies were getting hit left, right, and center.
For images of Ben Hogan here. How old are you guys?
Yeah. Well, I turned 85 yesterday. Honestly, it wasn't that long ago. But anyway, so it's like 1980 or 1981. So my caddy's out there and I started hitting. And then David Graham, who I think he'd already won two of his majors, hadn't lost to Sandy at Royal St. George's at that stage. So he was one of the premier players. Ben Crenshaw was there. I don't think Nicklaus was there, but Trevino was there. And Greg Norman and Jack Newton in those days. Bob Shearer, who was... So they're all like literally within 10 or 15 minutes of me starting, they were plonked on either side. And I honestly, I've never felt so small in my life. And then the sound of the club. And in the end, I just called my caddy in and I just walked off the range. I couldn't. I mean, the aura of that. And I remember the first time I went to Troon, I didn't qualify. And I went down to the range and there was Seve, Weisskopf, Nicklaus, Watson, Trevino, Graham, Faldo. I'm missing guys. It was literally 10 players in a row. And I was a Weisskopf fan. And Weisskopf had just won Westchester. I think it was 10 years after he had won at Troon. So there was talk again of Weisskopf. And I mean, I love the way he swung. He was my idol. And I watched him, and there was like a pole or something down the area. And he went, started off with like a 9-iron. And I mean, everything went at the pole despite the wind. Then a 7-iron, 5-iron. And he was hitting these 1-irons, and they never left this pole. Then he hit some 3-woods and some drivers. And I'm like, he's better than I've ever thought. So I followed him for the first three holes at Trent. He didn't get one on the field. I nearly burst into tears. I mean, he was like 50 yards left and 50 yards right and 50 yards left. So that sort of broke my heart. But just to see this lineup of a dozen great players and just watch them hit, you know, you've got – and it was who's who too, you know, because they're all different. You know, the vision of a Trevino, the way he swung as opposed to Seve, as opposed to Felder on those days, is Nicklaus and Norman. And I mean, it was the who's who, and the ball flights were different. And it was – I mean, if you took a kid there right now with today's players, that's what gets people interested in golf. I mean, after that, you're looking at the chops ready to go.
Frank, just earlier this morning, Joe and I, we were talking about it. I watched the official Masters film from 97, the Tiger one. And what struck me, two things struck me. One is that Tiger was like Marty McFly from Back to the Future. It's like it's like he traveled back in time with the modern game and just... It was like he was just transplanted from the future into an entirely different era. But I'm old enough to remember, like, I first started watching golf in the early 80s. And like, I remember all these great names. I remember Norman being the dominant player of his generation. I remember Faldo being amazing, then going away and coming back with a new swing and being even more amazing. I remember Seve. And I realized Seve wasn't a factor at this stage. But can you talk to us a little bit about like these great names that ended up being supplanted by age and Tiger Woods? But like you just talked about it, these were like the masterful players of their time that were as big then as, say, DJ or Koepka or Jordan Spieth or obviously Tiger Woods are today.
Yeah, I think a lot of the printed media, because there's not the same great writers there used to be, the same number anyway. There's a lot of people that just, you know, punch out 500 words. So they go for easy street. And one of the criticisms was, you know, hey, Tiger Woods didn't exactly play a great generation. Excuse me. I couldn't disagree more. It's very easy to make that assumption. But to answer your question, yeah, when you went back and at the various eras, I never got to see Ben Hogan. I actually choked on the opportunity to meet him in the mid to late 90s. Same thing as like Peter. I was like, I'd heard of, you know, the Ben Hogan's world. And so I've never seen Ben Hogan hit a shot. So I can't necessarily compare to that. I've seen Sam Snead. But, you know, you're right. When no matter what the sport, you know, I'm a Djokovic fan, believe it or not. And I know that really pisses a lot of people off. But purely because, no, the way he plays, you know, people say, well, why don't you like a Federer? And so when you just look at the way somebody plays the game, And to me, like, Djokovic doesn't have a weakness. So when I the same discerning eye that I would look at tennis as a kid when I was watching golf, and you saw a Trevino, I'm going to go back to Metropolitan. I was always told Trevino could only hit a cut, right? The 10th hole at Metropolitan was a dog-eared lip. He was playing with a guy called John Clifford, believe it or not. I remember that because John Clifford hit a Japanese guy in the chin on that very hole, and they kept replaying. It was horrible. But Trevino would just hit this little cut all the way around. Then he turned to the 10th hole, and he hit this magnificent draw, and it was mega long. I was really surprised. The same day, actually, I followed Greg Norman around for 9 holes. He never missed a shot. But so you it's easy to fall down that street. Oh, Ben Hogan hit it with a cut. Mm-hmm. I talked to John Mahaffey, who knew him better than most, and John wrote a book called Hogan's Boy, and so John literally was one of the first Hogan players, so he could tell me firsthand what it was like. So you know, you steal from that. But with my own eyes, I was, you know, first of all, led to believe Trevino only did this. No, he did everything. So when you saw players like that, when I saw, for example, Peter Thompson, even though later on, the shots that he would hit, and also the strategy, a place called Kyonga, he needed to birdie the last hole to tie. And you could normally, it's like a drive and a chip. And Peter Thompson laid up with an iron. And people thought he was playing for second place. Anyway, whacked a, you know, full wedge or a 9-iron into 15 feet, made the putt for a birdie. And people asked him about a strategy. He said, I needed 3 to tie. He said, I wasn't playing for second. That's the best way to do it. So they're all encompassing, not just the way they hit the ball, but because the way in which they had to play. They didn't have perfect fairways like they do today. So they had to manufacture things. So, you know, seeing Seve dump it out of a divot, I now have a vision of Seve holding a bunker shot at Trophy Lancome on the 18th hole, par three down the hill. He hit it in a left bunker, flag was on the left, and he's on a downslope. And he was mucking around, like trying to make a stance. And I'm looking at my caddy, I'm like, he doesn't have a shot. And then lo and behold, I still don't know how he did it. It came out so soft. Peter, you would have seen it as those type of shots. And it landed like a wet rag and it trickled in. And if it didn't go in the hole, it would have been Rob. It went in. And it's not the first time he did it. And in those days, ranges weren't as good. And Seve would go and find like a neighboring hole or whatever. And he would practice bunker shots at the start, before he played. Nobody did in those days. So you picked up little things that these great players did. Seve would always find a short game area. He's one of the few guys that chipped bunker shots before he played. Nicklaus, watching a player like that, and barely took a divot. All of Nicklaus's shots, admittedly towards the end of his career, even when I played with him, they all sounded like they were, sounds really bad, like a groove low. But I think because he could control the distance, like he found a way that he could guarantee it. Norman, everything came, he had a Merriman 3-wood. And I remember one of the times I'm playing with him, I picked it up, and this is how long I've been in America, I'm going to use the term a dime, which is probably, I don't know, this big. And it was, I said, did you sand that out? It was literally like a dot in the middle of this club that he'd worn it. Because a 3-wood, you're going to take a little bit of a divot every now and again. But he just literally worn a spot. It was so pure. And his irons were like that. And I was like so envious. And I could go through as many players as possible. So to me, I don't think there's ever a bad generation. Curtis Strange was one of the best players in the 80s.
Yeah.
I remember Curtis in his prime playing. I played with him as a 23-year-old in the inaugural Dunhill Cup. I was leading after, and I got waxed in the back nine. But, same thing. I mean, from 150 yards in, brilliant. And you just keep naming players. The Bruce Letskis, every generation's had great players. This is no different. I remember you talked about Harrington earlier. People look at Padraig now and the way he's playing, and they forget how well he played. We know he won three majors. But you also forget the other golf he played. I mean, he played so well over a small period of time. Mm. And we quickly forget. David Duval, too, he's not playing any good now. Got legitimate world number one.
Do you mind if I just jump in? Because when you mentioned Norman and Faldo, just so interested in those two. And we should be all eyes on Augusta this week, and we're not.
Yeah.
In 96, you finished fourth, which is worth stating. But the Faldo-Norman thing, they had some serious duels. The Open, like that Masters is kind of down in infamy. Those two as characters, like everything we hear about Norman, his weeks at number one, his prodigious ball striking, six majors to Norman's two. But that rivalry and those two as people, it'd be fascinating to get your thoughts on them, maybe starting with 96 and why that Sunday went the way it did.
Well, I think easiest comparisons is say, Greg Norman is the Ivan Lendl of golf. Lendl never won Wimbledon. Norman never won Augusta. Yet they deserved it. But the comparison between he and Nick, especially that Greg had actually persuaded me, I was still playing in Europe, to use rifle golf shafts. I remember, I'm trying to think of his name, he was based in London. Precision Golf Shaft, we're making this, it was a stepless shaft.
Malcolm Clark.
Yeah, Malcolm Clark, exactly right. So I remember Malcolm setting me up with a set of these shafts. And the first time I used them was actually in the Irish Open. And Greg persuaded me that they flighted so much better. They got the ball up a little bit and they evened out the flight. And he used to be a X100 guy, step shaft. So he started using that all the way through, probably from about 92, 91, all the way up to the 1996 Masters. And oddly enough, and it was for money, he did a lot of things because it was hot property.
Yeah.
So he used a ball that was inferior there for a while. I mean, he was charismatic. I mean, he looked great in clothes and all that. So he was a businessman. So he would often sell out, but to a certain degree, but he could still win. And he used a like a plastic type driver or resin driver there for a while. I remember playing him at the Dunhill Cup when he was using this thing. I mean, didn't use it for long, but I'm like, what are you doing? Like he used to have this Tommy Armour driver that used to sound like a gunshot. So anyway, but going back to 1996, two or three weeks prior to that, he changed back to Precision, sorry, to True Tampa. They wanted him back, and obviously I think some money was involved. And if you go back, he either missed two or three cuts in a row prior to Augusta. And the reason why I say that, it's the truth. People always tell one side of the story with Norman. But so by the time he got to Augusta in that first round, he was still dabbling, trying to get used to that flight. And Greg's bad flight was when it fizzed up with an iron and it just sort of stalled in the air and whatever. And that had gone away with the Precision shafts. So lo and behold, you have a pretty calm day on the first day and he shoots 63. And, you know, all of a sudden front page, and it was playing unbelievable. And I remember, because it's the first time I ever got to play with David Duvall, fast forward to the Sunday. And a lot was made of Nick making the birdie putt on 18 on Saturday to get into the last group. To be honest, I thought that was overblown, but I think they were right, because that was the one guy Greg didn't want to play with, just because nothing fazed Faldo. And plus his preparation is different. Faldo would get there at Augusta 2.5 hours before, just putt, 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 putt. So you saw him, and he was like a tank, like an immovable fixture there. You just knew that. And he was so successful in the mid-90s that you knew that the bit in there about getting the job done, he had it. It was in that vault of his. So he was going to find a way. And I remember seeing Greg on the range, and all I just said was good luck. And I was going to play Hilton Head and then go back to Europe. And he said, hey, I've got my boat next week in Hilton Head. Do you want to come? And he wasn't saying I'm going to win. It's going to be a celebrate, you know, or whatever. I just say good luck. It'd be great. You know, play well, usual thing. And I went off my own way. And I remember jumping into the tower with Peter Ellis with BBC when I just finished, and Greg was on the 16th tee. And I'd heard, you know, everybody talks about the roars at Augusta, but the moans or the silence are worse, because you know something's bad. You know, like you're just, and the great Vin Scully said, it's like Augusta's like a soup bowl. You know, when a cannon shot goes off, it reverberates all the way around the rim of the bowl. And so people always talk about good news. Well, bad news travels that way at Augusta as well. Mm. So when Greg started to miss hit shots, I mean, I hadn't seen them, but I remember saying to Peter Ellis on 16, you know, it's not over. You know, Felder's done a great job, but it's still going to be tough to win. You know, if Greg can put this in the middle of the green, you know, hey, there's still a lot to be played for. And he hit the worst shot I've ever seen. I mean, that nearly missed the lake on the left. And then I went back and I was able to see the round in replay, and shots like he hit at 12 and 10, the up shooters, they weren't there. And I still think some of that obviously is his fault, but also the change in shaft, because that shot, his bad shot came back on Sunday. And he's never used it as a defense. I'm not giving it as a defense, because Faldo's 67. And I still think that 2-iron that Nick hit off that side hill line to 13 is just one of the greatest shots ever hit in major championships, because he just inherited the lead. And it's so hard. You talk, Joe, earlier about one-shot leads in tight situations. It would have been so easy to bail out there, just take the fairway wood and hit a little long. He picked the hardest shot, and that was just an absolute dagger through the heart. It was great, but that's what Nick did. You know, same thing when he hit – The emotional win at Muirfield when he hit the great long iron over the back and was in tears. You know, I never met that Nick Faldo until working with him now. And I've got to like him, believe it or not. And we've had this conversation. No, and honest, and I basically said, why were you such a jerk? And I'd use a different word actually. And he said, there was no other way. I had to choose the best way for me to play. And Nick knew that golf is an individual game. He's an only child. That was the way. He understands, too, TV is a team game. So in order for us to win, we have to share. And to be honest, I got to see a side of him. I said, I wish I knew this side. I didn't trust it at first. And he's an anomaly, too. But at that particular time, it was blinkers on. It's the only way. And every now and again, you would see, like at Muirfield when he burst into tears, that deep down, I mean, he was like you or I. I mean, it meant so much to him. And he was a living, breathing human being.
God, that's there's so much in that. That's amazing. In terms of how collegiate it all was, so Faldo aside as the lone wolf, I like to picture you and all these legends just having a great time together and hanging out and swapping ideas. And this is how I hit this shot, and I'll see you in the bar either. or at the bar after? Was it is it that kind of a vibe?
Sadly, I could have been criticized for afterwards. I think I was dedicated on, but you know, I thought 24 hours in a day meant 24 hours in a day. No one really ever explained how much sleep, you know, the word sleep seemed to thing. So yeah, it was different. And that's why for me, you know, cutting my teeth in Australasia, first of all, so a lot of my best friends early on were Australians, and you know what Australia and New Zealand like, we hate each other except when we're elsewhere. So they became my friends, and a lot of that's over dinners and bars. And then when I went to Europe, you know, I still have so many friends there today because, you know, you stayed in a hotel in Germany where there was nothing else around. And sadly, you know, you know, there was a different language on TV. So there had to be another way to entertain yourself. So you went out somewhere hell, I remember going to a nightclub in Bingley, St. Ives, of all places. I mean, we did crazy stuff. To be honest, you could get away with it. I mean, there weren't these things then. I mean, honestly, they'd have your guts for garters now, seriously. So some of that stuff is best left and not talked about, Jake.
Frank,
Sorry, Peter, go on.
I just wanted to ask, Frank, you nearly made that same mistake yourself. When Joe sent me a text last night to say you were coming on, and I said, you know, I have to ask him this question about 1997, about Titleist and the Max Fly. Because I was, when I
How
grew
did you
up,
know about that?
I used to play a Max Fly ball.
How did you know about that?
Yeah, well, look, insider info. And that's a great story because it just goes to show you. And I learned something from it. I have to admit, when I turned pro in 97, that it was all about, you know, signing, you know, taking the money. It was about using the equipment that suited you best. And like you said about Greg there, about his shafts, you know, suiting him best and then, you know, changing for the wrong reasons. A lot of guys have made the mistake. I think if we look at Justin Rose, I think he made a massive mistake changing equipment. And a lot of top players have made that mistake. They've gone for the money, which is understandable. If it's there, you know, but you can actually make more money on the golf course and feel far more comfortable in yourself when you have, you know, free access to whatever equipment you want to use. So maybe you might tell us a story about 1997.
Thanks, Peter.
Is that me throwing you under the bus?
No, it's not. It's not. Actually, I'd forgotten about that story until you started talking about it. But I remember an old touring professional by the name of Terry Kendall. And when I was an amateur in New Zealand, he would allow me to play practice rounds with him. And he was telling me, you know, about golf in the future for me, really. He said, just remember, no matter who they are, they got two arms and two legs. They go to the toilet like everybody else. And he said, when you stand on the first tee, you're equal. Don't write them a check and give them to them or whatever. And then the other piece of advice was about equipment, which I forgot. He said, you know, unless they can pay you more than you earn, choose what's right for you. But ego gets involved. And, you know, you mentioned Justin, obviously, his pedigree. When you feel like, for example, in this situation, TaylorMade, they've got their stable and they're paying other people and maybe they drop their offer to you and you're like, no, I'm worth more. So you start looking around and there's very few people, Norman and Ernie else come to mind, that have been able to use just about every brand known to man. For the mere mortals like you and I think you've got to use what's best. So back in 1997, things were going good. I hadn't been diagnosed with inflammatory polyarthritis at that particular stage. And I thought, like everybody else, I was worth more money. And Maxfly made a good pitch. They wanted to put a golf ball and they wanted to put a pirate on it. I'm like, hey, great, we're going to do this pirate logo and all this. And hey, Fred Couples, Ian Woosnam, who I hated playing with because every time I played with him, he shot like 61 or 62. Woozy was using a Maxfly then. And I'm like, well, you know, uses it, Woozy uses it, you know, it's got to be a good ball. So I remember using it in Perth and nearly winning straight out of the gate, thinking, oh, this is pretty good. And then I went, you know, back to America stateside and, you know, it sort of didn't quite feel the same. And then I had my issues at the Mayo and then, you know, I lobbed up and I started missing cuts and I was on the medication. And then finally I finished it at Hilton Head, you know, the week after Augusta, and I didn't have a great Masters, and I'm sitting there licking my wounds, and Hilton has a very close thing. It's sort of like literally being at Port Marnock, nowhere else to go, right? Everything's in one little area. So I was bitching to my caddy, Pat Jansen, about, you know, how poorly I was hitting the ball. And you know, I'd go to the range and I'd hit it great. And then I'd go out on the golf course and after on a practice round, 5 or 6 holes later, I'd be hitting it crap again. And so so I said, okay, we're going to go and practice. No one else around. We're going to go out there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I warm up. I said, I've got to figure this out. So I hit it, you know, warmed up great. We go, we play the first 3 or 4 holes of Hilton Head and ball's not going the right distance. So I want to go back to the range again. So we literally went off the golf course, went back to the range again. All of a sudden, within 5 minutes, I'm hitting a grading it. Go out again, 2 or 3 holes to play like crap again. And I'm like, man, this is really driving me crazy. So we go back to the range again. I haven't even played 9 holes. And my caddy, Pat Jansen, says, hey, boss, can I say something? And I'm like, what? And I was in a really grumpy mood. He said, you're hitting it good here. I mean, it's amazing how clever caddies can be, right? And how stupid you can be. And he goes, you're hitting it great here. And you go out there and you hit it crap, right? He said, you know, do you notice any similarities there? And I'm like, yeah, I hit it crap out there and I hit it good here. He goes, no. He said, in those days, the only golf balls on the range were Titleist. So he said, no, boss. He said, you hit these, they're Titleist. You go out there and you put this in the bag. And I'm like, it's not that simple. He said, it is. So I'm like, no. So I said, okay, I'm done for the day. So anyway, my wife and I, we go out there in the little quarter deck in the area, and I run into a Titleist rep. And I'm telling my wife the story, and I want to fire Pat now. Because I think he's messing with my head. Yeah, he's messing with my head. He's crossed the line, all this sort of stuff. And my wife, who is a good friend of Annika Sorensen, actually had the same conversation once. And my wife doesn't know that much about golf except what I tell her. And she said, well, I told Annika that once. And I'm like, you idiot. You know, like, I said, well, what happened? She said, well, she switched back to her old golf ball and she went and won the US Open. Well, I don't want to hear about that. So we run into a Titleist guy called Bill Young. And I'm like, so now I'm thinking, my wife's just told me this story. I want to fire her as well. I want to fire my caddy. And I see Bill. I'm like, this is really weird. Why am I running into Bill Young? So I chat to Bill. And technically, I hadn't signed on the contract with Maxfly. Something had been screwed up. So I said, oh, Bill, we're at the same restaurant. I said, hypothetically, if a former Titleist player had changed brands, but hypothetically hadn't signed on the dotted line, hypothetically, what do you think? And he said, there'll be some balls in your locker tomorrow. So anyway, I put the balls in, you know, next day I switched around, made the cut. Very next week I won Greensboro. Didn't sack Pat. Didn't sack my wife. The worst thing about it was admitting that they were right.
Yeah.
Frank,
we're a funny old race.
Earlier on, you were telling a story about being next to Nicholas, and you went, oh, you know, next to the greatest player of all time. But wait a minute. I'm very much questioning. I was like, Nicholas the greatest of all time or one certain Tiger, Tont Woods?
Yeah, no, like I said, I think I prefaced and said at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird. I mentioned Djokovic before too because, you know, he's held all four majors at the one time. Hasn't been done since Rod Laver. Nicholas did some amazing things, and people will look at his second places as well. And I'm not trying to compare eras either, but you know, Tiger was ahead of the curve the whole way, and ahead of the race. Plus, having all four, you know, it's got to get extra bonus points. The win ratio, the most number of wins on the PGA Tour and around the world. He doesn't have the most, you know, Gary Player and all that, but his success rate around the world. But the way in which he's dominated the field, and that's why going back to what we were talking about before, when people talk about, oh, this generation, Ernie Els was going to be the guy, right? Mm-hmm. 6'4", 6'3", you know, Faldo height, strength. Curtis Strange said, that's golf in the future. So when you think of Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, you know, the fact that Rory can do what he's doing now, that's the anomaly. So they are the biggest, stronger, like every sport. Rugby's no different. Soccer, you name it. They're all the same. Tennis, I mean, they used to be 5'8", 5'9". They're all 6'3" now. So every sport just is trending like that. So to see Woods just demoralize, you know, the field, I mean, I played in some of those events. And he would hit shots that just Ernie told me once, the shot he hit at Hazeltine, which was a 3-iron on the 9th hole out of the fairway bunker. for a guy that has won four major championships to say that's the best shot I've ever seen in my life, I can't hit that. Now, Nicklaus hit some great shots, don't get me wrong. But I think for the time, and when to use Djokovic, if you start looking at strengths and weaknesses, you know, Seve wasn't always a bad driver. Seve in his younger days was actually a really good driver of the golf ball. And then it just became the easy thing to pick on. But weaknesses in the game. So when you look at Tiger Woods, I mean, I know he misses fairways and all that, but at one stage he was a great driver of the golf ball. Great fairway wood player, long iron, mid iron, you know, best iron player of all time is what we, you know, we all sort of agree. Turned into a great wedge player, great bunker player, great putter, and also a great putter in the moment. I remember having a, you know, talked about Weisskopf before. Mike Clayton and I were at Glen Eagles one year, and I finally got to meet my idol, Tom Weisskopf, and got to know him. So we're sitting down there. It'd been raining outside, and we're just having a cup of tea. And Mike was pestering him about questions, and he goes, who's the greatest putter of all time? Thinking that the answer would be Ben Crenshaw or Bob Charles. And he didn't even hesitate, and he says, Jack Nicklaus. And I'm like, well, that's not what we're all thinking about, Crenshaw, Bob Charles, all these other, Bobby Lyle. He said, no. And he said, Jack could hit it 30 feet away, nine holes in a row, and then hit it to 10 feet. Hasn't looked at a 10-footer all day, bang, and it went. It's about making it when it counts. He said, Bob Charles, Ben Crenshaw, they were good putters out of necessity. That doesn't mean they're great. So to use that analogy with Tiger Woods, there's so many big putts he's made in his career when they mattered. And the one he made at against Bob May, to keep the slam going in the PGA Championship at Valhalla, you know, that, you know, he was going to be beaten by, as what's normally happened to him, by, was Grant Waite one year, was Billy Mayfair, it was nicknamed Wai Yang. Yeah, Wai Yang was never like the head to head against a Mickelson, he never lost to like a Mickelson or an Else or that type of thing. So it almost looked like he was going to lose that championship to keep the, to keep the slam alive, and he had to make that sort of 6-7 foot putt. That, I think that's one of the greatest putts he's ever made. And then he wins the playoffs. So absence of weakness. He's hit more great shots. He's had more great moments, I believe, than Jack Nicklaus. So personally, I think he's played the greatest golf that's ever been played.
Right. And we by the way, we won't keep you too much longer, but just when he came on the scene in 97 and everything, you suspect for the likes of Montgomery and Faldo in particular, that was almost unnerving how dominant he was.
Yeah.
And then for at least a decade afterwards, it truly was at times Woods versus the field. So yes. Can you remember from your, you know, this was towards the end of your career, obviously, when he came on the scene, but even the talk in the locker room about this phenomenon, like what the hell is this kind of sorcery that we're seeing here? The reaction of other players, like Ernie Els must count all the majors he might have won, for instance, you know?
Yeah, a matter of fact, I remember seeing Ernie, the other house they used to have here at Lake Nona, and he was nearly in tears. He'd been beaten in Hawaii. And I think Ernie matched Woods for talent early on. I really do. And plus, he was bigger. So it's a bit like a box. It's like Mike Tyson. That's the one guy I have to beat. And I remember being in Thailand, and Ernie was there, and Tiger Woods was there. So there's two exercise bikes in the gym in the hotel, and we're both on the exercise bikes. And there's a TV screen up there, and Ernie's hitting a 5-iron into a par 5. And these days I got on pretty good with Tiger Woods, and it's different now with being on TV. It's not his fault. It's just different. And so we're both cycling away. Miller, he's fitter and younger than I was then. But Ernie, just magnificent 5-iron, boof, bang in the middle of green. And he goes, shit, he makes it look easy. And he put his head down and just started pedaling. So I really think that Ernie early on had the respect. And that's the one where he shot like 66 to Ernie 73 on Sunday and then beat him in that playoff and like did a number on him. So I think that the biggest difference with Tiger Woods is he took things personally. Like, and so therefore it wasn't about beating you once, it's beating you 5 times in a row.
That's an amazing story.
That was
story,
the difference. Yeah. He did things that nobody else did, that those runner wins. And you're right about the locker room. It was demoralizing because you would shoot 65 and you would go into the media center and there might be one question and you go, well, and the very next question was, Tiger shot 68. Are you looking in your revision mirror? You know, what do you think of his... So, and in the end, it sounded like hyperbole, but, oh, he hit 9-iron into the par 5. You're like, no, that can't be right. I hit 3-iron. And it was all right. And so really was like, you know, men playing with boys.
There was a certain adjustment, obviously, and later on it became very clear to the fields in every PGA tournament that Tiger basically raised finances for everybody. Everybody made more money because Tiger Woods is on the scene. But before that became kind of cemented in truth, was there a kind of a resentment on the part of, you know, some exceptional players? It's like, stop asking me about this kid. Stop asking me. Yes, he's amazing. Yes, he's brilliant. Yes, he's going to dominate the game. But, you know, it's like, was there a sense that, like, where players were going, oh, here, come on. Like, that there was a separation, and particularly Tiger, who didn't make it easy for him to like, to, or for others to like him, because he wanted to crush you. So was there a while when other players kind of...
Well, it's a great question, Finn. Yeah, it happened for a long period of time, and then the discussion was, is it racial, is it whatever? But
yeah,
it was, you know, I remember Curtis Strange, for example, and people take it the wrong way when he said he'll learn. And every generation you'd learn, you know, traditionally you played your best golf in mid to late 30s. And I do think that's an equipment thing. I do think, and I don't want to say golf was more artistic then. I think it's just like, that's easy street, you know, but it's like normally you had to develop, you know, your mind, you had to grow up as a man too. You know, you had to get that steel trap mind that we talked about, like Faldo. And so that took time. So you couldn't just come out at 21 and just blow everybody away. That wasn't possible. So in the interview with Curtis Strange, he goes, well, you'll learn. And that was, everybody felt the same way. So Curtis gets criticized as like, well, he said what everybody else said, except that we never thought that you could go, I'm going to win this and do it. And when you say golf, 144 people or 156 in a major championship. And we used to have, I know when I started doing TV, Tiger Woods against the field. This isn't tennis one-on-one at the same time. This is, you could be on the wrong side of the drawer, it could blow. His win rate was incredible. Yeah. So he was beating people on a lopsided game with his weather and conditions and all that, when the odds are stacked against. And I remember he was 11, it was 10 for 10 at a major championship. I think it was Medina. And I was working with Kelly Tillman, Branel Chamblee, and I think it was Brian Hewitt. And we would do these stupid things, you know, Tiger of the field. Same thing, it was Saturday. And I remember he was 10 for 10 with the lead. And golf's not perfect, Ben. So I remember, you know, it was the same thing. And Kelly said, oh, you know, Tiger of the field. And they all went Tiger, Tiger, Tiger. And I'm like, I got to take the field. I said, golf's not a game of perfect. I said, I cannot understand 10 for 10. Nobody's done it. Nicholas, any of those guys, they've never done it. So I sure as hell can't understand 10 for 10. So I'm not going to understand 11 for 11. So I'll take the field. Now he won. And I remember they were rubbing my face in it the very next day. You know, part of it was for show and part of it wasn't. And I remember my only comeback was, we'll never realize how good this is until it stops. Now, I'm not trying to say I was a prophet at the time, because I wasn't, but I'm like, I was angry actually. I'm like, we're actually taking this for granted. We really are. Because I played this game. What he's doing, I don't. And even now, it's almost like I watched a movie, because it just doesn't add. You know, it's just too good.
Yeah. For me, of the hundreds of mind-blowing statistics about Tiger Woods, the one that always stays with me is 142 tournaments without missing a cut.
Yeah.
With Byron Nelson second at 113 and Jack Nicklaus at 105. And that 38 tournament gap is massive. It's not just a small number. It's just, I can't even imagine, unless the Premier Golf League takes up and they have, like, you know, 2-day events or anything like that, I can't even imagine any player, no matter how good, ever even approaching that statistic.
The only way I tried to get that, to explain that stat in a coherent way, I said, I used the handicap system. I said, you know, should a 4 handicapper beat a 2 handicapper? And people would say, well, no, not really. But and Tiger Woods had shot 73 one day in like an opening round. And the scoring was pretty good. In those days, the stroke average was 68, or in this particular tournament, it was a good golf course. And they go, oh, you know, as soon as he shot anything over par, I was like, could he miss the cut? Could this be it? And I said, no. I said, all he has to do is go out tomorrow, not play good, play average. His average round, he's fine. Because it's better. Like, literally, his handicap, if we handicap professionals, he was 2 shots better than anyone else. So at the end of 4 days, he should beat the field by 8.
Yeah,
and he did. That's the, you know, because it worked out that way. I'm like, well, simple. I said, well, that's sort of what's happening. He's actually, he's your club champion, and you're the, and you know, we're the five handicapper, because every time he goes out, he's two shots better. At the end of the week, he's winning by eight, and that's what happens. And so even on a bad day, you know, like the two handicapper plays like a four handicapper, it's good enough to make the cut. That's the only thing. The only thing, it sounds really weird, Finn, but it's the only thing that explains making the cut, is that his level, his bar was so high that when he played poorly, it was still good enough to play the weekend.
Frank, just a very last one on Tiger then. We're going to chat about the Michael Bamberger book next week. We had Armin Katayan on about the previous Tiger Woods book. I suspect the man completely resents the amount of cycle babble talked about him as a personality, and the analysis of his character and the speculation about the second coming of Woods, the nicer person, and all of this stuff which goes around him. And it's understandable because of what he's done in the game, and frankly, because he is interesting. So, you know, even that story you tell of him on the bike, an amazing insight. So I'll keep the question open. Woods as a person, what do you think? What have you observed?
Wow. Because I still don't play golf, it's different. But I remember when I first met him in 1995, young, honest, open kid, right? And it wasn't until he did the GQ interview about the bawdy joke in the backseat of a limo that got out that he changed. So he started to become a little more closed-minded. And then also, I think he was, going back to what Fionn was saying about being resented, then there was the time where I think you're forced to change. Look what we're going through now, coronavirus. We have social separation. We're forced into this. So I think in some respects, we have to take responsibility for the way in which he changed. No question he has to too. But really, we forced him. You might say the same about Faldo to a certain degree, the way he was being ripped by the British media. In other words, you're forcing the personality to evolve a certain way. So then he became less trusting. And inside the ropes, you could actually joke with him. I remember playing with him at Pebble Beach one year in the AT&T. So he had a partner. His partner was Jerry Chang, and I was playing with a CEO of PNC Bank. And I was introducing, and he goes, "Hey, this is my friend Jerry." And I said, you could say it to him. Nobody was around. And I said, "You don't have any friends." And he sort of laughed, right? but I was sort of, you know, I was trying to jab him a little bit. But then I thought about it as we went around. You know, it's a pretty lonely life when, you know, if you tell your friend something and he goes and spills their guts, when you still feel very competitive. So he became very, very much closed down, closed down, closed down. And he became the master of the saying nothing interview. He could speak for 5 minutes and really say nothing. So it shows you that he's clever, but he's a golf savant. And then his peak started to rise. And obviously he performed so great on stage, his stage on the golf course. It was like, that's enough. You're going to get nothing of me out of here. And then when the Robert Lucetich book came out in 2008, when everything went haywire, everybody was scrambling to get to know. And we only knew all the bad things. So if somebody told only the bad things about you or only the bad things about me, some people might think we're pretty poor characters. So he felt really then betrayed by a lot of people. The Hank Haney book, the same, betrayed. This was his inner circle who he wanted to be natural with, telling a bad joke at a bar or whatever, like we all do. So he's like, well, I can't even do that. So then he really did close down. And then eventually, it's weird. I think the stage inside with all these adoring fans and the energy that he would pull from them, I think on the backside now, and some of it is, a lot of it is manufactured, don't get me wrong, but I think there's a general, when he goes to the tee now, I remember when he was booed at one stage. He went from idolized and clapped, and then just after 2008, I remember people, I went to the first tee, people were booing. Not all, but some. It was a different, totally different environment. And then now they're like, well, how much more can we see him play? And so part of it, I think, is the healing on both sides. In other words, people realizing he's human and allowing him to be human. And also, I honestly think there's the deep down in Tiger Woods is everybody wants to be liked. Is this, you know, I've done everything I could. I do have kids. You know, I know I screwed up some of my life, but I want to live, I want to live a while, you know, so there is a change there, but it's tough. You know, he's Michael Jackson. I've said that, you know, like the safest place for him was on the stage. You know,
I mean, everything you've just said is the way it should be. I mean, people are human beings. They're complicated. They're conflicted. You know, they're good and bad, et cetera, et cetera. But now that you're an analyst, there's lots of other pressures at play. How, firstly, how do you navigate the waters of being an analyst where you have to be interesting? Say, you know, criticize players when it feels like they should be criticized. But at the same time, you know these guys. So, you know, you have complex relationships with some of them. How do you represent the fact that you know these guys, that you know or you can imagine what they're going through, with also doing your job as, you know, as a kind of a top-rated analyst?
Yeah, no, thank you. It changes. Early on, yeah, I was more protective. I'd be lying if I didn't. You know, you didn't say things that you didn't think the public should know. And then after a while, I realized my first producer, a gentleman by the name of Keith Hirschlin, he said, with regard to analysis, he said, just call it straight. As long as it's not personal. And I think this is the difference. You know, we're doing, you know, radio podcast show. It's different. It's all encompassing. But I think if you're calling the sport, you know, I just read the Bill McLaren's book a couple of months ago. You know, I come from New Zealand, right? I think he's the greatest rugby commentator there's ever been. Just did his homework, called the game. And the game was interesting. It was phenomenal. That's what he did. I think as an announcer, that's our job. Now, the problem with the Golf Channel when I worked for there for a little while is we had different types of shows. So you're an analyst, a commentator, and one thing, which and I was doing two or three different genres, which I thought was hard. So now you're doing a studio show, which is a little bit like what we're doing now. And that's when you can get in hot water, when you cross them over. But it's also why I like live golf, because I think I'm allowed to say Tiger Woods had a terrible shot. Sadly, for clickbait, we get off the rails.
Yeah.
So and I still go back to, every time I doubt, I go back to my producer. And he just said, you know, what's on the screen, call it straight, you know, like that. As long as it's not personal. It's not what he did last night or whatever. You know, like you imagine coming on and go, well, you know, so-and-so on the first tee was drunk at the bar last night or whatever. And if that's innuendo or I haven't had that confirmed, and really, is that relevant to this tee shot? Mm-hmm. You know, there's not enough time anyway. If there's a, like the first hole at Augusta, the bunker on the right, uphill, trees on the left. You know, that's really my job. So I think it's just staying. You can do the job for a lot of different reasons. If you're doing it for popularity, which is different to a podcast, obviously. But when you're doing live golf, people tune in, and right now they miss golf.
Yeah.
But they would be tuning in this week to Augusta, not to hear people complaining about the players and what they did last night or for dinner or whatever, but analyzing what's going on during the course of the thing. And that's where it's different. So it's a great question, Finn. I know it's, you might think I've couched the answer, but they're all different genres. And I think you can go down easy street just for popularity and make a name, or you can just do the job. Bill McLaren, I mean, he announced for, like, was it 50 years? Because he was good.
Like, and I know you've moved now, so it's slightly different, but you and Chambly and Duval, that chemistry really worked. And you guys would say tough things. Yeah. So, you know, I'm talking away from, you know, idle gossip. But, I mean, say Rory at Portrush, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I was just looking back out of interest, and you called it inexcusable. And then Chambly, for instance, said, you know, Rory's historically had a bad run of first rounds, consistently gets off to a bad start. And then when the pressure is gone, all that talent arises and he plays a beautiful second, third or fourth round. When someone consistently performs under expectations, the word is choking.
Yeah.
So you could have analyzed, all of you, the McIlroy Portrush thing in a different way and it still would have been true. But I find you guys are really calling it now. And I would suspect for Chambly or for you guys, he necessarily mightn't have wanted to bump into Rory or in the corridor 10 minutes after saying that. But it's pretty rigorous stuff, and it can be close to the bone as well.
Yeah, no, and you're right. You know, to me, missing it left with an iron is inexcusable. I think, Chuck, everybody's nervous on the first tee. See, I disagreed with that from that point of view. And oddly enough, is now like, it's to me, you've got to be consistent. So if Rory hits it left and he's got an iron in his hand and makes eight, which he did, I also critiqued this finish. I said, the thing is, you know, I said he'll be more disappointed with those last three holes than what he would with the opening tee shot, which, to be honest, was correct. So, yeah, inexcusable what he did on the first hole, quadruple bogey on a very short par four. But the thing is, he fought hard, and he actually gave it away at the end, and that's really what cost him the cut, fought back. But you can do it for clicks, and if I throw the word choke in, I don't know what you're thinking. I can presume you're nervous and whatever. So to me, that's where I draw the line. And I go, yeah, I mean, I can use any different adjectives. And they're great because they finish up in an article and the clickbait. And that's where it's different. And yeah, maybe because I call more live golf. But, you know, people don't choke on the, you know, they get nervous. But on the, you don't lose a tournament on the first hole normally. You know what I mean? Like to me, if he'd made eight on the, you know, if he had a, I don't know, a three-shot lead, John Vandeveld, for example, even that, you know, like, and it was Rory and he made eight. Yeah, I mean, maybe then, but yeah, I mean, he's a Port Rush had taken since, what was it, 1951 or 1953 to get back. All of those years, finally there, get back. He'd already won an Open Championship. So the show sometimes could get out of kilter because you're right, there was a lot of honest conversation, but at times it can be, there can be sensationalism. And that's one of the things that I didn't like about TV golf because, see, right. I would go to the range and I have no problem if a guy would come up to me and complain and I would talk about it, say, look, you know, where was I wrong or where was I right? Because to me, you're trying to inform the viewer. In other words, if you know, I said that Rory hit a 5-wood this year at Torrey Pines and on the 13th hole, the par five out of the fairway bunker. And it was actually a utility club. I thought he put a 5-wood in the bag as a utility club. See, I was wrong. Now, I know it's a little thing or whatever it is, but to me, I should know the difference. And that's what the viewer needs to know. In other words, why does he put a utility club? That's a big difference. He never used to, as opposed to being personal on one thing or another. We're meant to be accurate first and foremost. So sometimes I think in some of those shows, as I was saying before, we can confuse inflammatory language for the sake of clicks to actually being accurate.
So is that why you're kind of more comfortable to get out of that?
Yeah, no, there was things that the way the panel was set up, to be honest, you go host, you know, which is almost like a halfback, and then you go, you know, chair A, chair B, chair C. And to me, you know, David Duval, I thought, should have always been in chair one or chair B, so to speak, because he's former world number one and won a major championship. And I thought that, you know, obviously Brandel's very TV savvy and you get off and running. So sometimes, like any discussion, if it gets out of kilter at first because you're meant to be balanced, even though it's not scripted, you're forced to then give the other side if you don't even believe it. Because if you just have a show where three people agree with a subject, then it's pretty boring. But it's like politics, you know, if all of a sudden someone has a rag, you know, you're meant to be doing a balanced thing, and someone has a go at Boris Johnson. So then now what? Do I got to talk about the Labour Party, even though, you know, I might want to, or, you know, do you have to balance it up? And that's where it gets, you get caught, because now sometimes you're arguing a point of view purely for the public's discern to make that conversation balanced and fair.
Frank, you talked about Brandel Chamblee. Most recently, this is a guy who's not afraid to say things that will upset people in golf, and certainly doesn't seem to dissuade him from what I assume is his heartfelt opinion. He's had a go. His most recent one is he had a go at modern coaching and all these. And particularly, he name-checked Cameron McCormick, Jordan Spieth's coach, and said he's ruined Jordan Spieth, which is pretty, pretty tough stuff to say. Like, having worked with him at close quarters for as long as you did, like is Chamblee, he's necessary, it would seem to me. It's important he raises points that perhaps a lot of others mightn't raise. But does he go too far? I mean, I don't want you to get him into trouble or anything like that. But at the same time, it's like, as someone who knows him as well as you do, what do you make of stuff like that?
Well, we started at the Golf Channel at the same time in 2004. And there was a definitive change, and I'm going to say probably 2008, 2009. We had a different CEO then, and it was almost like, you know, what do you want to do? I always preferred live golf, but I was, you know, we were strapped also for people, and also they liked me on that show as well. So, hey, it's a curse in some respects, but also a compliment. But yeah, the one thing I'll say, you know, he works really hard. I've never, ever faulted his work ethic. But there's a time when, you know, you are a group. And if you deliberately want to agitate and for effect, in other words, there's times in a game of rugby where you should pass the ball and let the other guy score. If you want to score all the points, then that's fine. So things got a little off kilter probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And I think the show personally became less enjoyable. And I think, you know, you can be subject to that popularity. There's no question, you know, he has a legal family, really, or legal background. So as he would say, they used to arguing on a Sunday morning lunch. It's always well-formed. But the thing that I hated was just when it was inconsistent. I have no problem if you have an opinion on something. But like Rory, you know, 1 minute, to use that example, 1 minute Rory's a choker, next minute he can't, everyone's playing for second. That's 6 months later. So to me, if we're just using the Geiger counter, then yeah, to me, consistency is key. And there should be a reason why you formulate that opinion. There should take a hell of a lot to change. I mean, is it once a choker, always a choker? You know, whatever is the case. I mean, to me, mm-hmm. people hit bad shots. If there's no out of bounds on the first hole, Rory makes 4 or 5 and off he's going. You know, so that little white picket fence there is enough to change the course of his Open Championship. And I think anybody knows that. But I also think if you go to the, you know, in order to report the game, and obviously I'm arguing my point of view here, you got to go to the range. You got to see him hit. I can look at shot length, for example, and see a stat. And I heard a doctor the other day that, you know, models or statistics, they're actually often wrong. Sometimes they're useful, though. So I can, if I know that you've shot 74 at the end of the day, I can find any stat to justify that. I can make you unlucky. I can make you sound like the greatest player in the world. Or I can make you sound like you played horrible just by cherry picking certain numbers and stats. I can do that. The same thing if you shoot 68 or 67, I can make it seem like you're the luckiest player in the world. So to me, when the job is over, it's very easy to find a convenient argument. But I would always like to go to the range, because once I got over the fact that I couldn't play, is that to me, golf, most of golf, that's where it's at. So I want to see if a guy hits it. I want to know what it sounds like off the club face. And if I see Brooks Koepka last month hitting it like this, and then all of a sudden that cut's not there, or it's not as high, or it's lower, then I might say, hey, have you changed balls? What's going on? Or how's the knee or whatever? Then I think I'm doing my job. If I just sit in front of a computer and look at that, and I just thought that's where it was deficient. Now, so obviously Duval and I would go down that route, and we would go to the range, and Brannel would slave over his notes and whatever. I do think that made the show work, but just every now and again, I think, you know, the ship would go off course for a little while. People loved it. Personally, you know, I didn't think it was, you know, if I don't think it was accurate, and you can have a different opinion, but you're entitled to.
And off air, would you say here, Brandel, we've lost our way a bit here. Let's come back to a surer footing off air or in debriefs.
No, because I think that's really what changed the last 4 or 5 years. There was a time there at the Ryder Cup, for example, where, you know, Brannel and David Duval went at it. Was written in what was actually written in accurately. And that was it, bang. I mean, it made for a very uncomfortable week. So, and that's what I mean. The show, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of, you know, controversy, depending on where you're coming from. And, but the thing is, you know, we are in this as a team. So once again, I'll look at the rugby player and that, yeah, you drop the ball, we're going to be angry and all that. But if you're trying your best and doing the right thing, but if you keep doing it on a regular basis, the rest of your teammates aren't going to like it. So there was times, once they went that way, it made for a very, very uncomfortable week. Hell, it's the Ryder Cup too. You know, it was such a great week. You know, so to me, we're meant to be part of a team. So it should never be that crossed. I mean, some of the management loved it. They thought great. And I said, you know, if it escalates, what do you want? You want someone to deck a guy on the, you know, on the set? And I said, because that's next. I said, hey, it's great. I'm all for difference of opinion. But if it has to strike a nerve for it to be good, I'm not up for that.
Nice. Okay, so you're at CBS now, and Peter Costas and Gary McCord no longer there. Peter Costas made his feelings very, very clear as to how he felt about how it all ended. But these were two names who were synonymous with CBS Golf for a very, very long time. Now that you're there, has CBS kind of said, look, we want you to build on this? Do they want a new direction? Like, what is there anything, is there any shift in the way CBS is going to cover golf?
No, there's no shift. It's timing. Matter of fact, I was texting Peter the other day. I have the utmost respect. Peter, for example, has helped me over the years because I've worked with CBS for 5 years before. I did CBS and Golf Channel, except it's just the workload's too much. I'm getting older. CBS, I can work 20 events. So for me, for Peter, you know, I leaned on him. Actually, he told me a couple of books to read. One is, you know, How Not to Not Give a, you know, the word on the back end, and also The Four Agreements, believe it or not. But Peter was also, I remember Frank Chikinian, the late great Frank Chikinian, the CBS producer, said the worst and best thing he ever did was employ Peter Costas, because Peter Costas was the first golf instructor. So Peter's, you know, it's tough boots to fill. And, you know, I don't know all the background behind that. You know, you hear you're different. You know, I've heard enough rumors, no different to the ones that you've heard. But he's a friend. Gary McCord, I've known for a long period of time too. You know, Gary, for his age, has a tremendous amount of energy. I don't think you replace them. I think you go in a slightly different direction. They can't. You know, there's certain people that can't be replaced. And that's a decision that every company goes to. So for me, no, the directive isn't to be like, hey, do what Peter did. I think, you know, there's a gentleman by the name of Mark Immelman, who's a golf coach. I don't know whether he's going to go down that route more. Gary McCord is, you know, his irreverence, the way in which his energy and his golf knowledge, that's pretty hard to replace too. So you know, people would think, you know, Davis Love's come in, Mark Immelman and Trevor. So, you know, I'd been there for 5 years doing this. So I'd like to think it's not like, hey, I'm taking one of their spots, even though I'm doing more events. To me, the way in which golf's been covered over the years, and I think it'll take a little while, because people, when they turn on, like I said, Bill McLaren, you're used to a voice. You know, I'm used to Peter Ellis's voice. I remember as a kid, Henry Longhurst, you know, Ben Wright, all these, Pat Summerall, all these great announcers. So to me, when I turn on a sport, I want to hear that. Like Dan Maskell, like I said, I'm a tennis lover. So when they're gone for a while, you miss them, because if you love the sport, you love the way they called it. So it's tough, and I empathize with the viewer. But, you know, nothing lasts forever, and I'm certainly not trivializing their move, because, like I said, they're tough boots to fill. But I think everything eventually goes in a different way. I remember when Gary Lineker, we had the same agent there in Europe for a while, when he decided to go into TV. It's people like, what the hell's he doing and all that? And then after a while, you get used to it. Nick Doherty is doing a great job in golf.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, he's too young. He shouldn't be doing it. So eventually you just morph into a slightly different thing. No, the way in which golf is covered is changing. It's more stats. You know, it's more different camera angles. I mean, it's more upbeat. It's meant to be supposedly for a younger audience. We'll try and get a younger demographic. So I think maybe it's people that they think are more malleable to what's out. Plus, the PGA Tour is going to take more control in the way in which the product is produced going forward from 2021. So it's all changing. You know, they want it digitalized. They want it to be streamed, all of that. So everything's changing, not just Peter and not just Gary.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could do an hour another day on broadcasting and even the Costas interview through 20 things, but we have kept you for more than long enough. Listen, it's been such an insight, absolutely fantastic to get you on. Big thanks, best of luck with the CBS News, and obviously in the short term, enjoy lockdown, and hopefully you and yours stay safe. But Frank Nobilo, absolute pleasure. Thanks again so much for giving up your time. It's really appreciated.
Hey, no, honestly, thanks. You guys have been great. Stay safe.
Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.